cathode. That is the voltage the control grid sees, so to speak. It's kind of hard to realize that the control grid will be seeing 50 volts even if it's grounded, if the cathode happens to be 50 volts away from ground. But you take that voltage, multiply it by the control grid current, and amps times volts equals watts, and if that exceeds 25 watts or comes near 25 watts, the alarm bell should go off in your head, and you know that your $700 tube is at risk. As I see it, with Mel's suggestion, with that amplifier, with the protection circuit, with the suggested power supplies that are in that ARRL book on RF amplifier classics, I think you're going to get almost all the information you need. That plus the IMAC 2 manual, which I'm sure that the 3CX 1500, as it's sometimes called, or the 8877, let me drop. You Google that number, you'll get a data sheet. And by way of that manual, the data sheet, the manual is going to tell you everything you want to know about power supplies and the control grid, the protection circuit. So the exact manual for your amplifier, for all you know, the person has already done some modification to it before he sold it to you. But once you see the theory of operation, and you'd like to know all this theory and have it in the back of your head before you use the amplifier the first time, because you do want to protect that tube. And so what you call amplifier is just a nest to properly hold onto the tube, to let the air go through it and supply the right voltages to it and monitor the currents that are going through it, resonate the plate circuit and adjust the loading. So it's a nest for the tube, if you know what I mean. The actual circuit, except for the protection network, there's nothing there very complicated once you understand the theory of operation. Over to you, Ian, for any further comments on all that you heard. Wait for the beep. K2RIW.
K2KY, one more thing.
I appreciate all the comments, Dick. The only thing is it has been modified. It's in original condition with all the connections. The control board that's on there that does all the protective monitoring of all the specs on the tube and the grid and the current and all the other stuff consists of a board that has probably about 12 ICs on there, probably about 20 transistors, probably a couple hundred components on there, with LEDs for different faults that will occur in the amplifier. So it has a pretty extensive control monitoring and protection circuit built in. So that's why I wanted to get a manual, so I could actually be able to connect that board to, you know, whatever power requirements it had voltage-wise, so I could use the amplifier as it is, as opposed to looking at one of those manuals or books and implementing some of the protective circuits that are given as examples.
Yeah, that is amazingly more complicated than I expected. Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. I'm just reading the article here. In fact, they tell you how, and it's very interesting, how to check the grid trip protection circuit, how to shut down the amplifier if the grid current exceeds 120 mils. And they tell you, actually, to do it, you know, you need the plate bulge on, or you can actually pop the tube out. And they tell you a procedure to check it, so you can easily go through this checklist. You really just have to see if the circuit is working, and I guess it will work the same in any setup because it's all going to the same tube. Also, how to pre-adjust the ALC, how to pre-adjust the grid idling currents, and the whole business. And basically, I guess this is the design. I can't see any really difference that you could possibly do with this amplifier, but it gives you enough information to go, you know, to make sure the amplifier is going to work correctly, actually, before you apply power to it. Everything, including the adjustment of the final amplifier and tuning circuit without power over.
In that RF amplifier classics manual of ARRL that you're looking at, Mel, roughly how many transistors and how many integrated circuits and whatever are in that protection network? In other words, what Ian describes sounds like an extremely elaborate protection network. It sure would be nice if what's in the classic manual is almost the same, but you're going to be able to tell us now how many devices are in that protection network, and is what he's describing sound a little bit different than what you're seeing? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, they built it basically. No, that's not what I see. They built it with just discrete transistors. And they've got one, the grid trip reset circuit. They got a thing for monitoring filament. They've got a mount. They got all kinds of monitoring and everything on there and how to do it. And just by using discrete components, see what they did. In his, there most likely may not be that many relays. They most likely may be using solid state, you know, later versions of a lot of these amplifiers. I've looked into, like, the new Alphas and all. They have gone away. They've gotten away with a lot of parts, like relays and all, and use these ICs and SCRs and things of that sort. But the basic circuitry, the basic ideas are still there, Dick. This was basically, of course, for homebrew design, so they used lots of places where I guess you could get away with SCRs and things of the modern version. They used just plain relays over.
Okay. When it comes to that amplifier itself, Model 410A, RF amplifier made by Scientific Radio Systems Incorporated, I think it is. Has anyone ever heard of that brand name other than Ian? Go ahead. Yeah, I'm a little bit afraid that finding the original manual is going to be a little bit difficult. I wouldn't just willy-nilly bypass that protection circuit, Ian. Even if you don't get a manual, with a little bit of enthusiasm, there's ways you can trace out the printed circuit board itself. In other words, this point connects to that point. This is a so-and-so transistor. That's a so-and-so integrated circuit. And you could write out your own schematic diagram, and by looking up those particular part numbers by Google searches and whatever, you'll eventually figure out exactly what's there, even if you don't have the original manual. So that you could reverse engineer it if you wanted to. And I wouldn't just willy-nilly rip it out. For all we know, it's doing a very good job. By the way, in a tube like the 8877 3CX 1500 A5 or whatever it's called, the recommendation is that you apply the correct filament voltage for something like 60 seconds to make sure the whole cathode gets hot before you turn on the B+. And the reason for that is you want the whole cathode at normal operating temperature as opposed to having hot spots. And if you turn on the amplifier too soon and you got hot spots in the cathode, you can do some damage to the cathode, which will affect tube life. So letting it warm up for the right period of time, for all we know, the protection circuit has a timing network in there that won't allow you to apply B+ until the filament's been on at the right voltage for the right length of time, and so on. That could be part of what's being protected. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW. I heard a triple, one at a time. Want to try again?
And two echo Oscar.
I heard Rich. Who was the other person?
KO2OK.
Okay, Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I just came upstairs. First off, I heard the price is bandied about on the 8877. When I bought that tube about 3-4 years ago, I got the old price from RF Parts, iMac, $1,100. Ouch. I want to make a suggestion to Ian, what I did on my Ameritron AL1500 when I made those mods. They normally give you taps to get the filament voltage. I think it's 5 volts. I always forget if that tube is 5 or 6 volts. I don't know why I forget. But what I did, Dick, I bought some surplus sales in Nebraska, a very small 120 volt 3 amp, with the smallest I could get, by wiring it into the primary of the filament transformer, not the plate, just the filament transformer, a 3-amp, 120-volt variac, because the amplifier is running off 208. I think you know the story. And the filament line runs off one side of the hot, and the neutral, so it runs off 120. And what I did was I put a test point on the RF deck, and I mounted the variac into the rear panel of the Ameritron, and so it couldn't be turned by accident. I used like a Pomona box on the back with an access cover, so you have to take that cover off to adjust the variac. And by going to the test point and a screwdriver adjust on the variac, once you take the four screws off the Pomona box, I could set the voltage very close with a digital multimeter, because IMAC, I forget what it is, 1%, they want the filament very close, and most people don't do that. They either undervoltage or overvoltage it, and that's no good. Back to that, and to EO.
Yeah, another very good suggestion there, Ian, and that is do monitor the filament voltage. When you got a tube that's that valuable, low voltage will possibly do some damage to the cathode, but certainly give you less than normal performance. High voltage will shorten the life of the tube, something fierce. I'm guessing the filament of a vacuum tube is not too different from a light bulb. In the case of a light bulb, when you run it at high voltage, 100 watt light bulb, for instance, you run it on a couple of percent higher in voltage, and you can get a huge number of percent of decrease in the life. It really happens fast. Bennett, what would you like to tell us about this? KO2 OK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. KO2 OK, and you have my name right, Bennett. 8877, you asked about the filament voltage. It is 5 volts, and as Rich said, you've got to keep to that. It's very sensitive. It could have life expectancy much shorter, plus or minus that 5 volts, so you want to have it right on if you can. And there is a 3-minute warm-up. And as you said before, the grid voltage, grid current, has got to be monitored very carefully, and that is the very sensitive part of the tube. That's about it. I had a home-built one for 6 meters, and I have a commercial one by Henry for HF. And they're good long-lasting tubes if you, if you supervise them carefully.
Yeah, you follow all of these rules on the forced air-cooled external anode ceramic insulated tubes, and you can get many decades of life out of them. Some of my original 4CX250B tubes from the so-called RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier are still in operation. And that amplifier, let me think now, I originally built that in 1971, way back in the dark ages. It appeared in the February and March issue, I think it is, or April and May issue, 1972 of QSC. We're going to delay Paul a little bit with his space report, and we've exceeded 9 o'clock, and let's go over to Mel's mailbag. So what kind of burning mail have you been getting this week, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. First of all, let me say that I get emails and everything, and telephone calls from KC2LYU. That's Danny in Florida. He moved to Florida. He listens to us every week. And he said, please mention to Dick.
Good.
I say hello. Haven't talked to him so long. Okay, so Danny, you're signed in, KC2LYU, from Florida. All right, final word. Collins, I have the Collins amp with a pair of them in there. And they have a source start for the filament to begin with, a relay that has a 20 watt, 25 ohm resistor in series with the filament transformer, and that sets the source start. Then you have a position you go to for filament on the multimeter, and you have a filament voltage adjuster. That That's how they do it in Collins, and it's been successful because those are old tubes, and it's still working. All right, I'm just reading over here what in the heck we got. Good going. All right. I got a little setup here, and what do you suggest the best? Okay, let me let it drop just a little bit of detail. Okay. We're also all the new hams and all, and because we just got involved with amateur radio and it's winter time, what is the best antenna you can think of that we can simply use, say, in a simple window installation or something that we can do? Because right now, doing work outside, you know, and trying to install something decent for 2 meters, 440, is pretty difficult. I know you couldn't get back in my backyard to the tower in any way, but it's snowed in there pretty good. So what do you suggest that people should do for 2 meters, 440, or say a simple thing by a window or a windowsill or whatever? What do you think is the best simple antenna, Dick, overall? Go ahead.
If you're in the below ground apartment, window antenna may not give you very much performance, but as long as you're a couple of feet above the ground, as long as you're a couple of stories up, there's an amazing number of guys that run a simple mag mount antenna, 5/8 wave mag mount. I'll explain that one in a minute. And they simply connect it to an air conditioner, or run it even sideways, connect it to a refrigerator or to the case of the computer. There are a number of guys who run a simple mag mount inside the building with them. And as long as they're talking to local repeaters that are not a zillion miles away, that has worked out very well. There's a number of guys in the five boroughs of New York City that are doing that. If you're now trying to talk to the single sideband people, quite a few guys have built up homebrew Yagis, particularly on 432 megacycles, where you built it out of a coat hanger wire, and the boom can be a piece of wood or a piece of PVC pipe or so on, mounted on a tripod inside the building with them. An amazing number of guys have had moderately good performance with that if you're on a an apartment that's relatively high up. Let me drop. So, omnidirectional, vertically polarized antenna, the advantage of a 5/8 wave is that anything that's close to half wave means that the ground plane radials become almost unimportant, and the amount of metal you've got for the case of your computer or the case of your air conditioner or the side of the refrigerator or the top of the refrigerator is more than enough. Or in some cases, guys have connected the mag mount to the metal rail that's on the balcony outside the window, so to speak. So simple half-wave-like antennas can give you a lot of bang for the money. But if the guys you want to talk to are single sideband and horizontally polarized, I'd recommend a homebrew Yagi. Anything more than three elements can give you some pretty good performance, depending on how much room you're willing to devote to the project, and a simple tripod to hold it and aim it. And as long as you're not running a kilowatt into the antenna, having the antenna in the same room with you is not dangerous. Slightly controversial here, subject. In the case of the mag mount, you don't want to put your head alongside of the mag mount when you're radiating 50 watts. As long as you're more than, let me pick a number, 3 or 4 feet away from the mag mount antenna with 50 watts into it, as far as radio frequency biohazard is concerned, you're safe. And there's simple ways I could tell you how to do the calculation. So I wonder if you think that this is close to what he's looking for, Mel, or is he looking for even higher performance? K2KEY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Oh, I'll tell you, when you're in a situation with, you know, apartments and got the restrictions, I know a couple of people that basically, in fact, talked to one today who gets on 10 meters in the 10-meter net we have on Sunday mornings. He sneaks out onto the fire escape and clamps an antenna out onto the fire escape just to get onto the net, and then has to remove it because he says, you know, he doesn't want to take a chance that it'd be spotted, you know, under any kind of situation where they're doing inspections or whatever. He figures like a Sunday morning is pretty safe. However, there was once a mention that you could put an antenna, you could make a simple dipole if you wanted that kind of arrangement, either, as you say, horizontally or vertically, using this tape that they, I still think they may sell it as Radio Shack, I'm not sure, called the, you know, the alarm tape that's used for taping windows for alarm contacts. I think you know what I'm talking about, that silver type foil, something like that. What do you think of that, Dick? Over.
WS2N.
Paul recognized copper tape, and I use it all the time. The copper with sticky stuff on the back, and you peel away the paper. Boy, there's a zillion ways you can make antennas out of those. In the case of the aluminum-like tapes, the ones that are used for heater ducts and whatever, there the hard part is making good contact to it. It's very difficult to solder to aluminum tape. And so, yeah, there's ways of still making contact, but you got to work at it. Let's see what Paul's got to contribute here or ask. WS2N, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
Okay, yeah, Mel, I looked all over everywhere, Radio Shack, and the internet. You just can't buy this tape because it's lead-based, you know, for the alarms anymore. So, you know, I took the aluminum tape that they sell, and I just cut it the same width. You know, I needed another one for one of the windows that broke. So, yeah. You know, you can make your own, but then you're going to come across the problem that Dick talking about attaching it to the aluminum. But if you can find a way to do it, you can make your own. It's just that you can't buy this anymore. I think you can't buy the tape. You can't buy the clips. You know, that you attach to the window. I found one place in Yugoslavia or someplace that they might sell you the clips, but. The tape, forget it, Mel. I can't get it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I was a bit afraid that finding the tape is going to be hard and making electrical contact to the tape. You'd like to be able to solder a wire to it, and that's tough. So making good contact to aluminum tape is tough. Copper tape, there's no problem soldering to it, and you can make it any width, any length, whatever. Finding the copper tape, it's going to probably have to be by mail order, and I believe the stuff is a little bit pricey. And there's nothing magic about making an antenna out of tape. You'd be amazed when you find the right article, and there's lots of them when you do the right Google search, what you can do with coat hanger wire or the 14-gauge household copper wire. Lots and lots of antennas. The square loop Quaggy antenna, for instance, by K6YNB, Wayne Overbeck. You Google those words, K6YNB, I think he's now N6YNB, and the quad loop Yagi, which has got a wooden boom, 14-gauge household wire, copper wire is the driven element, and the rest of the elements can either be pieces of copper wire or pieces of coat hanger wire. So there's lots of ways of making an inexpensive antenna, and the fact that you can tape it against the window, if it was real tape, there's nothing stopping you from making the equivalent out of copper wire and taping the copper wire to the window with any kind of tape that'll just hold it there if you want it against the window. But a mag mount on an air conditioner or a computer case or on a refrigerator, lots of people are doing that in the metro area, and they're quite happy with it. They're not breaking DX records. But as long as you've got some local repeaters and other people, even sideband people, to talk to, you're on the air having fun, and once you start talking to them, they'll make other suggestions to you, and you can slowly improve the system if that's what you want to do, and find ways of stuffing attic antennas into the attic and through a hole in the closet and whatever. I've heard all kinds of stories along those lines. K2KEY, K2RIW.
The comment, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Evening, Dick. No. KC2WGB. Quick answer for that. I've used the sticky backs that you use for supporting tie wraps. I've stuck them to the window and threaded 18-gauge wire through the little loops, and it works perfectly, and it comes out nice and neat. Just pass that along because it works well.
Yeah, what I think you're talking about are these small squares, about 3/4 of an inch square, where you peel the paper off the back, and the square will stick to anything. And on the front of it is a loop which will accept a tie wrap, and the tie wrap will hold anything against glass, porcelain, wood, whatever. Where do you buy those, and roughly how expensive are they, John? Over to you, John.
Dick, I believe they're available in Home Depot now. If you go to Electrical Supply House, you usually have to buy a bag, I think, of 25. You don't need the tie wraps. They have a closed loop on them. You thread the wire right through the loops. But you should be able to buy them maybe in a 5-pack. Sometimes they come stuck together. But they're relatively inexpensive. They're made by Thomas Betts, those type of people.
Radio Shack has them too, Dick. I use them all the time to make.
Okay, so what used to be called Radio Shack, which is now called The Shack, because they've changed names again, changed ownership. And by the way, as we discovered last week, the fact that you go into your local shack, what used to be Radio Shack, and they don't have on the wall what you want, don't be discouraged. We're finding there's huge differences. In other words, you could have two shacks that are two towns apart, so to speak, one town apart, and one of them have three times as much stuff as the other, depending on what they think really sells. Some of them get sucked into the false belief of an efficiency expert. I mean, I've watched the Arrow Electronics Company, the Harrison Electronics Company. I've watched many of these companies, Lafayette Radio, whatever. A lot of these companies used to sell parts. Because they sell parts, the electronic tinkerers will congregate to that store. While they're in the store, they'll buy other appliances, tape recorders and phonographs in the old days, and television sets and hi-fis and whatever. They don't shop around. They're already in the store. There it is. They buy it. Some efficiency expert comes along and said, each one of those little bins on the shelf in the back room for these parts, you're not getting very much money out of it. Let's drop it. Well, you drop that, and the people don't come to the store. And people don't come to the store. They don't buy the appliances, and you go out of business. And I've watched lots and lots of companies to do that. And I hope Radio Shack, some of the individual Radio Shack stores, I hope they're not doing that. Because it's very false economy. I mean, what gets people to the store, even if it itself is not making you a profit, you don't want to turn your back on that. Over to you, Mel. By the way, if the particular antenna design you're looking at requires tape to be put against the window, and you want to build it out of copper wire instead, to make a loop of wire that has the same outer dimensions as the tape will give you almost exactly the exact same performance. There's nothing magic about it being tape. A loop of copper wire in the same dimensions as the outer dimension of the tape will behave the same. So you can make a non-tape equivalent of a tape design if that's what you're following. But there's lots and lots of antenna designs that are using coat hanger and copper 14-gauge household wire. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Leo with a comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Quick comments about Radio Shack. What I found works very well. A lot of the employees in the stores, they're not well trained. They're hardly trained at all in electronics. So if you go in there and you say, I need 100K half-watt resistor, they don't know what you're talking about. They just say, we don't have it. And they do have it. What you have to do, and I always do this when I go to Radio Shack, I first go online to RadioShack.com. I scan from the part, and then I make a printout on a sheet of paper. It allows you to do that. A printout with a picture of the part and the Radio Shack catalog number. Then I go to the next section, which says find the local store. I put in my zip code. I see which store has it. I go there. I give them the paper, and I say, give me this. And that works 99% of the time. The other thing, I agree with you, Dick, because, you know, I've been buying parts for Radio Shack for years, and I was in there recently for something, and I upgraded to an iPhone 4. I had an iPhone 3G. I upgraded to an iPhone 4, which is like a $300 iPhone, because I went into Radio Shack for something else, and they have the iPhone on special.
It's amazing how short-sighted many of these stores become and don't realize what's really bringing people to the store. Hello to Daniel, KC2LYU. He lives in Lantana, Florida, which is in Palm Beach County. I bet you he's nice and snug and warm down there while we're freezing up here, and we're supposed to get the, I think I'm supposed to go below 10 degrees tonight at my house, and I think we're supposed to be getting snow, a little bit of snow for a change coming down on us on Wednesday, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
They're saying 3 degrees in Rockaway tonight.
Oh, and you're near the water where it's supposed to be warm. We're going to go over to Mel, and then we're going to go over and pick up Paul's space report, and then Barry in that order. Sounds like he's off the phone. Mel, you've got it.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very good. Thank you for mentioning Danny. Make him happy, make his day. So, Danny, yeah, he's been talking to him a while ago. He called me just before 8 to please sign me in. All right. Signed in, and we all acknowledge. And, yes, it's a little warmer down there, but they've had some cold spells, so they haven't had the heat that you expect when you get down to Florida, I guess, this time of the year to get away from this. You still need some clothing on. Okay, as far as, the windows here, like on the door, the front door and side door, the windows were wired with that aluminum tape, and then at the end, you know, the loop, they had those two screw contacts for the wires, the hard wiring, to go to the next, place, and I realized that that's no longer available because that was a good way to make contact to that aluminum tape. As far as the copper tape goes, they use it in the roofing industry. They got a very flexible, very thin copper tape, but it comes, like, I think it's about 3 or 4 inches wide. And I don't know how much is on a roll. Have they sell it by footage or whatever it is, if you want that. It's got the back, sticky back, and you can peel it and use it. But you'll have to strip it down thinner. Okay. With that, I guess, let me see. Hold on 1 minute. Let me look anything final here. And just hold on 1 minute. Okay, we answered the whole question. Yeah, so, okay. As far as those little electrical supplies also have those little stick-on type of devices. I use them alarm. Places that sell alarm supplies, very definite with that. So you buy them by the bag, and they're very cheap. So I could say they're a good source of sticking to the windows, putting up the antenna on the windows, and the walls, on the wall, whatever. And then when it comes to removing it, just take them right off. So I think that's a good way to go, a cheap, simple way to go, and like you say, easy to make contact to the copper wire. All right, I guess that takes care of that subject pretty well, so let's go on. It's getting late. This is K2KEY back to net.
Yeah, one of the things that's not common sense is that radio waves are amazingly good at getting out of tight spaces. Just because you feel like you're indoors and you're in a shell that's protecting you from the weather. And common sense would lead you to believe you think that if the antenna is not outside the house, that the radio signal is not going to get off the antenna. Very few houses are really RF tight, if you know what I mean. Obvious by the fact that a cell phone operates very well inside of an automobile, a metal cage, and that signal squirts out through the windows very nicely. And so the amount of attenuation you're getting from your house, the difference between an outdoor antenna and an indoor antenna, in many cases is only a fraction of 1 decibel, a very small difference. Making the antenna higher up in altitude always helps. you had the option of installing the antenna on the second floor of your residence versus the first floor, go for it if you can make that happen. And even if you've got to put the antenna on the second floor and run a coaxial cable down the hall, you know, taped against the corner of the wall and bring it down to the living room on the first floor, consider doing that, because altitude on frequencies like 2 meters makes a huge improvement, even when it's indoors. Okay, yep. Paul, next, let me drop. I'd like to pick up Paul for the space report. Barry then is going to tell us the latest on his beautiful 2 meter, correction, 80 meter vertical, full vertical half wave dipole. Then I'd like to have a few words with Glenn about what he's doing with the Doppler scanner and the improvements he's making there. He's got some beautiful pictures of the changes he's made that he could mail you if you request it. He's finding ways of making improvements on the Ramsey kit. The Ramsey kit, when you build it for a Doppler scanner, it works, but it's not 100% in performance, and there's ways of making it better, and Glenn's in the process of rediscovering and discovering his way of doing it. Now, Paul, when it comes to the next space shuttle, the astronaut that was supposed to be on that space shuttle is the husband of the lady that got shot in Tucson, and so I guess there's some doubt as to whether or not he will have the freedom to go on that next space shot. And what a tie-in. I believe his brother is already on the International Space Station. He's supposed to be on the next shuttle flight, and his wife gets shot. Terrible circumstances there. WS2N with our space report, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yes. His brother, Scott Kelly, is commander for the 6 people on board the space station now. And he's halfway through his tour. He's got a 6-month deal up there. He's about 3 months into it now. And, you know, it's a typical problem that they've discussed for decades. You know, what would happen if somebody's on a long-duration flight, you know, in orbit or going to the moon or even Mars, you know, and they get a report that, you know, somebody in their family has been hurt or injured or, you know, what do they do? You know, this comes under that category. You know, like he would love to come down and support his brother and visit the sister-in-law, but, you know, he can't do that, you know. And they all know this when they sign up. It could be one of his parents or something like that, you know. And that's always been discussed, Dick, but if they know this before they go up, you know, they just don't pull out of orbit, bring the person down and go back, you know, send the crew back up again and finish the mission. It just doesn't work that way. But, yeah, that's true. Let me drop it. Yeah, Mark Kelly is scheduled to go up on Endeavour, and now scheduled for middle of April, actually, the 19th of April. And whether or not he'll go or not, he's been training for this mission for over a year, and now he's taking time off when they're getting down to the wire here. Will he be replaced? I don't know. There is a replacement already in line, ready to go, in case he does not go. Now, she's been doing very good lately. Got her to a rehab center. They flew her to Houston, one of the better rehab facilities in the country. And it turns out it's also in Houston where where they all live and train. Might be better for him if things work, you know, go better. Right now they seem to be going good. A little bit of a setback I heard today, but if that goes well, I think he might go. Let me drop it. So hopefully it works out. That mission was supposed to be the final mission. Read on a couple of websites, not officially on a NASA website yet, but Yahoo News and space.com, and there's different websites that they have approved another mission after Endeavour, after Mark Kelly's flight by Atlantis, and that will be a four-person crew called STS-135, and that will be scheduled to go up in end of June, right around field day, June 28th, that time frame. So that will be the final mission. They want to bring a lot of supplies up there. That's one of the main goals. They plan that with Kelly's flight, but they need more stuff up there. As much as they can, the big things, replaceable, the things that need to be replaced in orbit, only could be brought up by the shuttle. Need to be done. The ISS, let me drop it. Has now officially been approved to go beyond 2020, which was the original cutoff date. So, you know, they'll keep that thing up there probably forever. And but to do that, they need as much supplies as possible. They do have quite a few unmanned flights going up between Japan. The European Space Agency has a rocket there. We have the Progress ships. A couple of them are going to be going up very shortly. I think there's six that will be going up this year alone from different countries. Not the SpaceX one. That's ours. It's a private corporation that tested their flight out just recently, and everything went fine. But they probably won't be starting until maybe the beginning of next year if things go good. So that's the story on that, Dick. I wanted to bring that up. And also, I don't know if you saw on the internet or anywhere else about the Delta IV launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Did you see this thing? Take off. It was a spy satellite, Dick.
No, give us some more words on that one, Paul.
Okay, yeah, this is the last thing on my list, but it's a heavy lift vehicle. Delta IV is, I mean, it just can carry tremendous. I think it's 1.7 million pounds of thrust, something like that. But it's a heavy lift vehicle. They've launched, I think, three of them from Florida in the past, recently, but first time this heavy lift vehicle from Vandenberg took off. And this is a launch site that was originally designed for and built for the space shuttle before the space shuttle Challenger blew up. There were plans of launching many flights from Vandenberg, manned space flights using the shuttle, and most of them were going to be military missions, spy satellites and all this stuff, but they had plans on doing this on a regular basis. So that was all scrapped. They launched a few big Titan rockets over there, but now they're using this Delta IV, and it's if you watch the video, it was a real nice launch. Hard to describe. It's normally, like, it looks like the size of like one of the solid booster rockets from the space shuttle, and then a rocket on top of that. That would be the second stage, and then payload, a big heavy payload. And then side by side to this thing was two other rockets that looked exactly like the one in the middle. And it's a real nice, very strange looking configuration. So you've got these three rocket engines lifting this whole thing off the pad. I never saw the ones launched from Florida, so the first time I saw this thing go. And with
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
One of the things that I mentioned before, Paul, is that this new X-ray telescope, very high energy X-ray or cosmic ray telescope, to my knowledge, with this extremely heavy magnet, was going to be brought up on the very next space shuttle mission, and by way of a spacewalk, it was going to be installed outside of the International Space Station. And I've forgotten the name of the darn thing, and I did a quick Google search. Maybe I didn't use the right words. I haven't quite found it. To your knowledge, is that going to be on board this very next shuttle flight? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of it, too. I remember you brought that up a while back. You know, that's on this flight, the Leonardo Logistics Module, which was a module that they'd bring up, big thing that they brought up in the back of the cargo bay many times. They would attach it to the space station, unload supplies, put more supplies back into it, and then the arm would put it back, you know, the Canadian robotic arm would put it back into the space shuttle, and then they would bring it back to Earth. That's going up, and then the Robonaut, the big robot, it's actually the size of a person, will be on that flight built by GM, and then this telescope that they're going to permanently mount to the space station. And what the name of it is, I don't recall. I'll look up in a press section. If you go to NASA and you bring up the press section, press report or whatever it is, on SDS 133, you eventually come to the payroll, and they have dozens and dozens of things that are on that, and that's how I'll find the acronym for that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm looking for that right now. It's a very high energy. I know that every time they build a telescope in space where they look for higher and higher energy events, they keep finding it. No matter what they put up there, there are certain events that happen that will saturate whatever high energy detector they've been using in the past. Okay, let's go over to Barry, N2 Moon Bounce, if you're available, Barry. What's the latest on that antenna of yours, and as far as the amount of blockage you're going to get from your tower, Aero Motor, I think it's the name of the tower. I keep calling it Windjammer, but I think it's called Aero Motor. Yeah, Aero Motor. I finally got it right. I can tell you how much blockage it's going to get, and it's a lot less than you think. N2MB, if you're there, K2LIW.
I'll look that up for next week, WS-1-73.
And if you find it this week, let us know the name. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, yeah, I've only got a few seconds. What you're saying is you don't think the tower is going to have much of an effect, which is good. I've been just trying to figure what I'm seeing in the results, and what I'm getting is to the west, in the United States, I'm always better on the horizontal antenna, the two half waves in phase. It's always better on that one. And sometimes it's considerably better, so it's not just coincidental. When I get out into the Pacific to the west, as far as Australia and New Zealand and Japan, I can't tell which antenna is better. It's almost a toss-up. However, when I go to the east, towards Europe, the vertical is always better. The vertical outperforms the horizontal antenna. I can tell you where these stations are just by their signal strength. That's how much it outperforms it. So I was trying to say, why am I getting this apparent degradation to the west? And the only thing I can think of is it was my tower. There's nothing else in the way, unless it's coincidental. I don't know. So what are your opinions on that one? K2RW and 2MB. And the next.
Oh, yeah, what's going on?
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to Mel in a minute, but I'm guessing some of it is propagation conditions. To my knowledge, you've got the antenna pulled away from the tower by way of the feed line, pulling toward the house. And as I remember, your tower is almost, let me think now. I remember when I was on your tower, Empire State Building was in the background. You're southeast of the Empire State Building. So the tower is northwest of you. So you've got a very tiny blockage to the west. Let's first find out what Mel feels about propagation. Then I'm going to tell you how you can calculate what the tower is doing, and you're going to be amazed how small it is. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's the propagation on 80 meters has been very strange, to say the least. Even crazier on 160, but 80 meters seems to have caught some of that, 160 meter disease, or whatever you want to call it, because the things that are happening, you know, don't usually associate with like 80 meters. I'm only on a CW portion of the band with my vertical, my 80 meter vertical, which is 65 feet tall, and, with 100 radials buried. And I noticed that when I'm getting the, for instance, like Australia out to that way, I'm hearing the African stations, which means that the propagation is pulling towards that east. It's not the short path, of course, to the Pacific would be westward. But usually the pathward seems, for some reason, is always pulling, I think because of the sun's angle, Dick. You got to remember that, the sun, how it's traveling, it's setting in the west with it rising in the east. So when you're getting that propagation, it's in the sunrise, usually over.
KC2, QAQ with comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I have a possible idea what might be going on. Most of the contacts that I do in HF over to Europe generally follow the short path, and the short path from Long Island, or this general area, to Europe is north of east, and if his dipole is more west or southwesterly, he's really not going to have a good angle at Europe. It's really got to be set up for like a northwesterly position. If you look at the Great Circle, pattern from this area to most of Europe, it's generally north of east. I'm just wondering if Barry could probably mention what the direction of his dipole is really set up for. Is it truly set up for north of east to try to contact Europe? Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
It's my belief that Barry's antenna is very close to a pure half-wave vertical omnidirectional. Even though it is a vertical inverted V, so to speak, call it an inverted V that's mounted on its side, where the center is pulled away from the tower, and I think it's being pulled down to the southeast, roughly. I still think he is primarily an omnidirectional antenna. Here's why, Barry. The most bedrock formula for the whole science and art of antennas is gain equals 4 pi A over lambda squared. 4 pi is a constant. Once you fix the frequency, lambda is constant. So gain is a constant times area. That's it. Every antenna, once you know the true gain of the antenna over isotropic, you plug it in that formula, you know the area. So area equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. The lambda, the square of the lambda, that's a constant. The 4 pi is a constant. So gain is, area is gain times a constant. You actually plug in the numbers for an 80 meter dipole. I kid you not. An 80 meter dipole, if your eyes operated at 80 meters, let me drop. If your eyes operated at 80 meters, and you stood off to one side, and you look at that dipole, what would you see? You would see a oval-shaped area in space, where the oval is placed around the dipole, where the longest dimension of the dipole and the longest dimension of the oval would be parallel to each other. The shortest dimension would be in the perpendicular to the dipole. That oval black hole in space is what your eye would see, would have 8,500 square feet of real area. As long as the frequency is on the one that you're listening to, let's say 3.7 megacycles, and as long as it's got the right polarization, vertical, that oval, that great big black oval in space, 8,500 square feet of area, is where that dipole is sucking up RF energy, applying it to the feed line. It goes down that feed line and moves the S feed around that receiver, if you know what I mean. You can't get away from that. Now, if I make reasonable dimensions for length and width of that oval-shaped object. And the oval is going to be a little bit bigger than the length of the dipole and quite a bit shorter in the other dimension, but still the 8,500 square feet as an oval, you figure that out compared to the area of that aeromotor tower. You'll find out that the aeromotor tower is probably blocking, let me pick a number, 25% of the area. That if the aeromotor tower was a thoroughly solid metallic object and didn't have any holes in it. Well, at 80 meters, I think all those holes are almost not there. Each one of those is waveguide beyond cutoff. So at 80 meters, I'll admit that your tower acts like it's got sheet metal on the side. It is a solid metallic object, as if you had filled in each one of the three sides with sheet metal. But now you calculate the area of the tower versus the area of the real dipole electronic area, and maybe you're blocking one-third of the dipole or one-half of the dipole, which is a couple of dB loss, that's all. In the direction of the dipole, in the direction of the tower, you're getting some blockage of a couple of dB, worst case. Maybe it's only 1 dB, and we can go through that calculation. So therefore, to the most part, that RF energy flows around that tower, and the majority of it still goes where you want it to, in the direction through the tower. So where you're getting these crazy propagations in certain directions, I think it's Mother Nature, not your antenna itself, is my belief, Barry. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. I hear you. I'm just not sure, because the results are so predictable. I mean, I've been making measurements now for months, and it's really a predictable thing. I don't know. But I'm going to prove it, because the other element within the next 60 days, I guess, will be up. And that will be, of course, on the other side of the tower. That will become, I guess, that will become the director, right? You transmit into the driven element, and the other element becomes a director. Am I correct on that?
You can make the other element a director or a reflector, strictly as a function of how you feed it, Mary. The antenna will always fire in the direction of delay. I'm not sure, but I'm going to make a guess, and you're going to correct me. Assuming your tower is northeast of your house. Northwest. Assuming the tower is northwest of your house.
No, it's not. My tower is almost west of the house.
Okay. So therefore, east-west, you see a great big difference. And west is the direction where you have to transmit through the tower, and you've gotten less signal in that direction, and you think the tower is causing it. However, Mel and other people are discovering that there's kind of crazy propagation going on. So, now, let me drop. If you feed the element on the west side of the tower, a signal that is later than the signal on the east side of the tower, the signal will fire to the west. You always fire in the direction of delay. So, assuming you've got an all-fed array, and that's what you're going to be doing, you've got a feed line to each, and you can decide which one is getting the early signal and which one is getting the late signal. The guy who gets the late signal is the director. That's the direction that you're going to go in. A phased array, whether you're talking about the angles or when you're talking about an end fire, in either case, it fires in the direction of the delayed signal. So you can select the signal to be strongest to the west or strongest to the east, depending on which one you lead and which one you lag when it comes to those two feed lines coming into the shack and the way you you operate your switching network to put the quarter wave or whatever it is, delay line in one versus the other after the power divider. Wonder if that makes some sense, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW.
K2KY with another comment.
Barry first and then Mel. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, yeah, it makes sense. That's kind of what I thought was going to happen. So if the if I'm transmitting into the dipole, which is on the east side of the tower, the element which is electrically driven is going to be on the west side of the tower. I would be firing towards the west. That's what you're saying.
You used ambiguous language, so I can't give you a yes.